And in the 1880s and 1890s, the spirit of populism and the empiricism of the social sciences drove American newspapers to a newfound obsession with facts. The journalist, like the political scientist, was an invention of the 1880s. The Journalist, a trade publication that identified journalism as a new profession that shared with the social scientist a devotion to facts, began appearing in 1883, the year Joseph Pulitzer took over the New York World. Pulitzer, a Hungarian immigrant who hadn't known a word of English when he arrived in the United States, had served in an all-German regiment in the Civil War. After the war, he studied law in St. Louis and began working for a German-language newspaper. He made the World into one of the nation's most influential papers. "A newspaper relates the events of the day," Pulitzer said. "It does not manufacture its record of corruptions and crimes, but tells of them as they occur. If it failed to do so, it would be an unfaithful chronicler." William Randolph Hearst began publishing the New York Journal in 1895. Hearst, born to great wealth in 1863, his father had struck gold in California, had taken over his father's paper, the San Francisco Examiner, in 1887, after dropping out of college. In 1896, Adolf Oakes, the son of a Bavarian immigrant and lay rabbi, took over the New York Times. Oakes, raised in Tennessee, had started his career in newspapers by delivering the Knoxville Chronicle at the age of 11. He left school 3 years later. He was 38 when he bought the Times and pledged his intention to publish without fear or favor. The newspapers of the 1880s and 1890s were full of stunts and scandals and crusades, even as they defended their accuracy. "Facts. Facts piled up to the point of dry certitude was what the American people really wanted," wrote the reporter Ray Stannard Baker. Julius Chambers said that writing for the New York Herald involved facts, facts, nothing but facts. "So many peas, it's so much a peck, so much molasses, it's so much a quart." A sign in the Chicago Tribune in the 1890s read, "Who or what? How? When? Where?" The walls of the New York World were covered with printed cards. "Accuracy, accuracy, accuracy. Who? What? Where? When? How? The facts. The color. The facts." In 1895, Pulitzer's New York World endorsed Mary Leese as a candidate for mayor at Wichita. After she lost and her home in Wichita was foreclosed, she moved to New York and decided it was the heart of America. She campaigned for Henry George, who was running for mayor. It looked as though he had a chance, but he died in his bed of a stroke 5 days before the election. His body lay in state at Grand Central Station. More than 100,000 mourners came to pay their respects. Leese delivered a eulogy, and the New York Times reported, "Not even Lincoln had a more glorious death." In the summer of 1896, William Jennings Bryan, a man Oakes's New York Times called an irresponsible, unregulated, ignorant, prejudiced, pathetically honest, and enthusiastic crank, chugged across the plains in a custom railroad coach called the Great Nebraska Silver Train, which was decorated with giant signs that read, "Keep your eye on Nebraska." He was heading for Illinois to the Democratic National Convention at the Chicago Coliseum, a three-story building that took up an entire city block, where he would deliver one of the most effective and memorable speeches in American oratorical history. Boy Bryan, in his baggy pants and his black alpaca suit, had come to Chicago to fuse the People's Party into the Democratic Party, to turn the party of white Southerners into the party as well of Western farmers and Northern factory workers, leaving the Republican Party to be the party of businessmen. The wind was at his back. The Democratic Party had for the first time endorsed an income tax, so that the burdens of taxations may be equally and impartially laid to the end that wealth may bear its due proportion of the expenses of the government. But naming Bryan as its presidential candidate would be a far greater step for the Democratic Party than adding a plank to its platform. Bryan leapt to the stage. "I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty," he said. "The cause of humanity." The struggle between business and labor had been misunderstood and rested on too narrow a definition of business. "The people are a broader class of businessmen. The man who is employed for wages is as much a businessman as his employer," Bryan said. "The farmer who goes forth in the morning and toils all days and who, by the application of his brain and muscle to the natural resources of the country, creates wealth, is as much a businessman as the man who goes upon the board of trade and bets upon the price of grain." Opposing the gold standard, the Republican Party's central economic policy, Bryan brought together his Jeffersonianism with his revivalist Christianity. "There are two ideas of government. There are those who believe that if you will only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperity will leak through on those below. The democratic idea, however, has been that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up through every class which rests upon them. As he closed, hollering to a crowd more than 20,000 strong, he placed upon his head an imaginary crown of thorns. "We will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying unto them, 'You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns.'" He stretched his arms wide and bowed his head. "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." And then he shut his eyes and fell as still as death. "My God, my God, my God," the crowd began to chant. They took off their hats and threw them up into the air. Those who didn't have any hats took off their coats and threw them instead. Anyone who had an umbrella opened it. "Under the spell of the gifted blatherskite from Nebraska," a reporter for the New York Times wrote, the convention went into spasms of enthusiasm. Bryan, the gifted blatherskite, was much mocked, especially in the big cities of the East, by newspapers favorable to business interests. The Times ran the headline, "The silver fanatics are invincible. Wild, raging, irresistible mob which nothing can turn from its abominable foolishness." Even Joseph Pulitzer's far more man-of-the-people world refused to endorse Bryan. Populists, meanwhile, feared that fusion would destroy their movement. "We will not crucify the People's Party on the cross of democracy," said one delegate from Texas. But in the end, the People's Party threw its support behind Bryan, mounting no candidate of its own. Even Mary Leese gave him her grudging endorsement. At the People's Party convention in St. Louis, she seconded his nomination. And socialists supported him. Eugene Debs, the Indiana-born labor organizer and later the head of the Socialist Party, wrote to Bryan, "You are at this hour the hope of the Republic." Bryan ran against Republican former Ohio Governor William McKinley, who represented the interests of businessmen and ran armed with a war chest of donations made by banks and corporations, terrified of the possibility of a Bryan presidency. Ballot reform, far from keeping money out of elections, had ushered more money into elections, along with a new political style, using piles of money to sell a candidate's personality, borrowing from the methods of business by using mass advertising and education, slogans, and billboards. McKinley ran a new-style campaign. Bryan ran an old-style campaign. Bryan barnstormed all over the country. He gave some 600 speeches to 5 million people in 27 states and traveled nearly 20,000 miles. But McKinley's campaign coffers were fuller. Republicans spent $7 million, Democrats $300,000. John D. Rockefeller alone provided the GOP with $250,000. McKinley's campaign manager, Cleveland businessman Mark Hanna, was nearly buried in donations from fellow businessmen. He used that money to print 120 million pieces of campaign literature. He hired 1,400 speakers to stump for McKinley, dubbing the populists "papocrats." They agitated voters to a state of panic. As Mary Leese liked to say, money elected McKinley. Leese, disgusted by the election, left populism behind in favor of journalism. Pulitzer hired her as a reporter. On Election Day, 9 out of 10 American voters cast secret government-printed ballots. McKinley won with 271 electoral votes to Bryan's 176. Black men hardly voted. Women and Chinese Americans, not at all. But for the first time in decades, no one was killed at the polls. Bryan and his wife collected clippings and published a scrapbook. They called it The First Battle. 4. In 1892, Americans marked the anniversary of Columbus's first voyage across the Atlantic by hosting the largest ever World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition, on 600 acres of fairgrounds in Chicago and more than 200 buildings containing thousands of exhibits, pavilions representing 46 nations, and not least, the first Ferris wheel. Among the fair's hundreds of public lecturers stood two men who proposed to consider the course of American history from the vantage of the last years of a tumultuous 19th century. Frederick Jackson Turner, 31, a dashing young historian with a mustache and a bow tie, wanted to explain the rise of American democracy, a triumph and a beacon. Frederick Douglass, 75, an aging statesman, his hair a cloud of white, proposed to explain the rise of Jim Crow, a descent into a dark night. Turner, born in Wisconsin in 1861, was one of the first Americans to receive a doctorate in history. At the exposition, he delivered his remarks before the American Historical Association, an organization that had been founded in 1884 and incorporated by an act of Congress in 1889 for the promotion of historical studies, the collection and preservation of historical manuscripts, and for kindred purposes in the interests of American history and of history in America. History and journalism became professions at the same time, and like journalists, historians borrowed from the emerging social sciences, relying on quantitative analysis to understand how change happens. Where George Bancroft, in his History of the United States, had looked for explanations in the hand of Providence, Frederick Jackson Turner looked to the census. The difference between Turner's methods and Bancroft's signaled a profound shift in the organization of knowledge, one that would have lasting consequences for the relationship between the people and the state, and for civil society itself. Like Darwinism, the rise of the social sciences involved the abdication of other ways of knowing, and indirectly contributed to the rise of fundamentalism. Across newly defined academic disciplines, scholars abandoned the idea of mystery, the idea that there are things known only by God, in favor of the claim to objectivity, a development sometimes called the disenchantment of the world. When universities grew more secular, religious instruction became confined to divinity schools and theological seminaries. But in the 1880s and 1890s, those schools were dominated by liberal theologians like the Congregationalist Washington Gladden, men who were modernists. Gladden devised what came to be called the New Theology, accepting evolution as consistent with a living Christian faith and understanding its discovery as part of humanity's journey toward the kingdom of God. A theologian at the University of Chicago's Divinity School defined modernism as the use of scientific, historical, and social methods in understanding and applying evangelical Christianity to the needs of living persons. Increasingly, this is exactly what evangelicals who eventually defined themselves as fundamentalists found objectionable. Their leader was William Jennings Bryan, who would earn the nickname Mr. Fundamentalist. Modernism shaped faith, and it shaped history. Turner titled his lecture, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, and in it he attempted to account for the sweep of history over four centuries. Influenced by both Jefferson and Darwin, Turner saw the American frontier as the site of political evolution, beginning with the savages of a wilderness, proceeding to the arrival of European traders, and continuing through various forms of settlement, through the establishment of cities and factories, the evolution of each into a higher stage, and culminating in the final stage of civilization, capitalism, and democracy. Turner proposed the thesis at an exposition whose exhibits included some 400 Native Americans on display in what amounted to human zoos. Turner derived his ideas about evolution from the same early anthropological work that shaped those exhibits. But he based his analysis of the frontier on a quantitative analysis of the findings of the 1890 census, the tool with which the state counted the people, a census that had been tallied in record-breaking time. The 1880 census had taken 8 years to tabulate, but in 1890, the Census Bureau's Herman Hollerith, an engineer from Buffalo, New York, who taught mechanical engineering at MIT, introduced a reform that allowed for the census to be tallied in just a year. Inspired by the punching of railway tickets done by conductors to identify passengers by sex, height, and hair color, Hollerith made punch cards that could automatically tabulate all of the traits surveyed by census takers, the characteristics of citizens. Hollerith fed punch cards of 12 rows and 20 columns into a tabulating machine he'd designed. In 1896, he founded the Tabulating Machine Company, which would eventually merge with a number of others to become a firm called International Business Machines, better known as IBM. In The Significance of the Frontier in American History, Turner used Hollerith's figures to calculate population densities across the country, and from them to argue that there was no longer any discernible line between settled and unsettled parts of the continent. He argued that the frontier, which he described as the meeting point between savagery and civilization, had been opened in 1492 and closed 4 centuries later. But while it lasted, in that meeting place, American democracy had been forged. American democracy is fundamentally the outcome of the experiences of the American people in dealing with the West. by which he meant the experience of European immigrants to the United States in defeating its native peoples, taking possession of their homelands, and erecting there a civilization of their own. This, for Turner, was the story of America and the lesson of American history, evolution. Frederick Douglass, more than twice Frederick Jackson Turner's age, was scheduled to deliver his own lecture on August 25, 1893, the fair's designated Colored People's Day. The Columbian Exposition was segregated, not by Jim Crow laws, which didn't extend to Illinois, but by racial convention, which did. Even the guards were all white. Only the janitors were black. Douglass, who as former U.S. ambassador to Haiti had represented the nation of Haiti at the Haitian Pavilion, was the only eminent African-American with a role at the fair, whose program had been planned by a board of 208 commissioners, all white. There were, however, black people at the fair, on display. In the Hall of Agriculture, old men and women, former slaves, sold miniature bales of cotton, souvenirs, while in a series of exhibits intended to display the Turnerian progress of humankind from savagery to civilization, black Americans were posed in a fake African village. As if to shame the Negro, Douglass wrote, they exhibit the Negro as a repulsive savage. Douglass had planned to deliver a lecture called The Race Problem in America, but Ida B. Wells, a 31-year-old black woman with wide-set eyes and her hair piled on top of her head like a Gibson girl, went to see Douglass at the fair to try to convince him not to deliver the address, and instead to boycott Colored People's Day, a travesty that Wells dubbed Tambo and Bones Negro Day. The daughter of former slaves, Wells was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi, in 1862. In 1883, while working as a school teacher, she'd been asked to leave the ladies' car of a train and move to the car for blacks. She refused, took her case to court, and began writing for black newspapers. In 1892, after three black men who'd opened a people's grocery were lynched, she began writing about the threadbare lie that Negro men rape white women. Fierce and fearless, Wells urged black militancy and armed resistance against lynching and against Jim Crow. She recommended a Winchester rifle. The more the Afro-American yields and cringes and begs, Wells wrote, the more he is insulted, outraged, and lynched. When Wells founded her own newspaper in Memphis, she called it Free Speech, carrying on the long tradition of making free speech the centerpiece of the struggle for racial justice. After a white mob burned the offices of Free Speech to the ground, she moved to New York, where she published under the pen name Exiled. In 1887, she was elected secretary of the Black-run National Press Association. In 1892, when she published her first book, Southern Horrors, Lynch Laws and All Its Phases, Douglass wrote a testimonial, saying that his own voice was feeble by comparison. In 1893, when Wells went to see Douglass at the Chicago World's Fair, they decided to go to lunch. Wells wanted to go to a restaurant across the street, but wasn't sure if they'd be served. Only whites were allowed. Come, let's go there, said Douglass. The waiters looked at them, astonished, until they recognized Douglass. Pressed by Wells, Douglass, who was more than willing to condemn the fair, agreed to provide an introductory essay to a pamphlet called The Reasons Why the Colored American is Not in the Columbian Exposition, in which he insisted that any true representation of the American nation had to be honest, and that, as much as he wished he could tell the story of America as a story of progress, the truth was different. From slavery to Jim Crow, the history of the United States, he argued, involves the necessity of plain speaking of wrongs and outrages endured and of rights withheld and withheld in flagrant contradiction to boasted American Republican liberty and civilization. Still, as hard as Wells tried to convince Douglass to boycott Tambo and Bones Negro Day, he decided to go ahead with his address. When the day came, he arrived to find the fair decked out with watermelons and white hecklers waiting for him. With the careful halting steps of an old man, he climbed to the stage. "Men talk of the Negro problem," he began. "There is no Negro problem," he said, his voice rising. "The problem is whether the American people have loyalty enough, honor enough, patriotism enough to live up to their own constitution." It was one of the last public speeches Frederick Douglass ever delivered, but not the very last. On September 3, 1894, an ailing Douglass made the journey from his home in Washington to speak in Manassas, Virginia, at the dedication of an industrial school for free black children, a school for learning how to build. A ship at anchor with halyards broken, sails mildewed, hull empty, her bottom covered with seaweed and barnacles, meets no resistance, Douglas said that day, turning the idea of a ship of state to the problem of Jim Crow. But when she spread her canvas to the breeze and sets out on her voyage, turns prow to the open sea, the higher shall be her speed, the greater shall be her resistance. And so it is with the colored man. He paused to allow his listeners to conjure the scene and its meaning of a people struggling against the sea. My dear young friends, Douglas closed, accept the inspiration of hope. Imitate the example of the brave mariner who amid clouds and darkness, amid hail, rain, and storm bolts, battles his way against all that the sea opposes to his progress, and you will reach the goal of your noble ambition in safety. 2 years later, Douglas, 77, collapsed in the middle of an after-dinner conversation with his wife about the emancipation of women. He'd spent the day in suffrage meetings with Susan B. Anthony, one of his closest friends. He'd had a heart attack. At his funeral, attended by thousands of mourners, the minister took as his text, "Know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? Accept the inspiration of hope." Months later, Douglas's challenge to the American people to live up to their own constitution haunted the halls of the Supreme Court when the justices took up once again the matter of citizens, persons, and people. Homer Plessy, a shoemaker from New Orleans who looked white but who under Louisiana's race laws was technically black, had been arrested for violating an 1890 Jim Crow law mandating separate railway cars for blacks and whites. Plessy had contrived to get arrested in order to challenge the Louisiana law. John Ferguson, a judge in a lower court, had ruled against Plessy, and in 1896, the Supreme Court heard the appeal, Plessy versus Ferguson. By now, judicial review had come to be understood as the paramount power of the court, a power wielded by the state against the people as represented by their legislatures. In 1892, the president of the American Bar Association declared judicial review the loftiest function and most sacred duty of the judiciary, unique in the history of the world. In a 7-1 decision in Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling and thereby made the landmark ruling that Jim Crow laws did not violate the Constitution by arguing that separate accommodations were not necessarily unequal accommodations. The 14th Amendment promised all citizens the equal protection of the laws. The majority in Plessy versus Ferguson asserted that separation and equality were wholly separate ideas. We consider the underlying fallacy of the plaintiff's argument to consist in the assumption that the enforced separation of the two races stamps the colored race with a badge of inferiority. If this be so, it is not by reason of anything found in the Act, but solely because the colored race chooses to put that construction upon it. The resulting legal principle that public accommodation could be separate but equal would last for more than half a century. The sole dissenter, John Marshall Harlan, objecting to the establishment of separate classes of citizens, insisted that the achievement of the United States had been the establishment, by amendment, of a constitution that was blind to race. Our constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens, Harlan wrote, and it is therefore a plain violation of the constitution for a state to regulate the enjoyment by citizens of their civil rights solely upon the basis of race. Consider the absurdities, contortions, and contradictions of Jim Crow laws and with the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, Harlan urged his colleagues. Under the terms of the Chinese Exclusion Act, immigrants from China could not become American citizens, but under the terms of Louisiana's railway car, a Chinaman can ride in the same passenger coach with white citizens of the United States, while citizens of the black race in Louisiana are yet declared to be criminals, liable to imprisonment, if they ride in a public coach occupied by citizens of the white race. Harlan was not attempting to protest discrimination against Chinese immigrants. Instead, he was pointing out the absurdity of a set of laws that grant more rights to non-citizens than to citizens. What all these laws had in common, Harlan argued, was that they were based on race. And yet a war had been fought and won to establish that laws in the United States could not be based on race, nor could citizenship be restricted by race. The court's opinion in Plessy, Harlan warned, was so dreadfully in error as to constitutional principles that the judgment this day rendered will in time prove to be quite as pernicious as the decision made by this tribunal in the Dred Scott case. This prediction proved true. How does it feel to be a problem? W.E.B. Du Bois asked the year after Plessy v. Ferguson established the doctrine of separate but equal. One feels ever his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideas in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. A citizen, a person, a people. 4 centuries had passed since continents separated by oceans had met again. A century had passed since Jefferson had declared all men equal. 3 decades had passed since the 14th Amendment had declared all persons born or naturalized in the United States to be citizens. And now the Supreme Court ruled that those who would set aside equality in favor of separation had not violated the nation's founding truths. And one of the most wrenching tragedies in American history, a chronicle not lacking for tragedy, the Confederacy had lost the war, but it had won the peace. Chapter 10, Efficiency and the Masses. Walter Lippmann wore a 3-piece pinstripe suit the way a tiger wears his skin. But the clue to his acuity came in the raised eyebrows, as pointed as the tip of an arrow. Educated at Harvard, where he'd studied with William James and George Santayana, he'd seemed destined for a distinguished, if quiet, career as a professor of philosophy, or maybe history, when he decided instead to become a reporter, the sort of man who tucked his pencil into his hat band, except that he wasn't exactly that kind of a reporter. He invented another kind, the learned political commentator. To read, if not to comprehend, Lippmann was suddenly the thing to do, wrote one much-wounded rival. By 1914, when Lippmann was 25, he'd already written 2 piercing books about American politics and helped launch the New Republic. He was heavyset and silent. His friends called him Buddha. He lived with a who's who of other young liberals in a narrow 3-story red brick row house on 19th Street in Washington that visitors, including Herbert Hoover, who once ate an unlit cigar there over dinner, named the House of Truth. Theodore Roosevelt called Lippmann the most brilliant young man of his age in all the United States, which was but small comfort to older men who found their ideas unraveled by Lippmann like yarn in the clutches of a kitten. How did a man so young write with such authority, matched by so wide appeal? Oliver Wendell Holmes said Lippmann's pieces were like flypaper. If I touch it, I'm stuck till I finish it. In the last decades of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th, when Lippmann came of age, industrialism brought great glittering wealth to a few, prosperity to the nation, cheaper goods to the middle class, and misery and want to the many. The many, now numbering more than ever before, talk of the people yielded to talk of the masses, the swelling ranks of the poor, haggard and hungry. Like many Americans of his generation, Lippmann started out as a socialist, when even mentioning the masses hinted at socialism. The Masses was the name of a socialist monthly published in New York, and especially after the Russian Revolution of 1917, which brought the Bolshevists to power. Bolshinstvo means the majority. The masses sounded decidedly red. But Lippmann soon began to write about the masses as the bewildered herd, unthinking and instinctual, and as dangerous as an impending stampede. For Lippmann, and then for an entire generation of intellectuals, politicians, journalists, and bureaucrats who styled themselves progressives, the term dates to 1910, the masses posed a threat to American democracy. After the First World War, progressives refashioned their aims and took to calling themselves liberals. Only someone with so great a faith in the masses as Lippmann had had when he started out could have ended up with so little. This change was wrought in the upheaval of the age. In the years following the realigning election of 1896, everything seemed suddenly bigger than before, more crowded and more anonymous, looming and teeming. Even buildings were bigger, big office buildings, big factories, big mansions, big museums. Quantification became the only measure of value. How big? How much? How many? There were big businesses, big banks, big railroads, big oil. U.S. Steel, the first billion-dollar corporation, was formed in 1901 by consolidating more than 200 companies in the iron and steel business. To fight monopolies, protect the people, and conserve the land, the federal government grew bigger, too. Dozens of new federal agencies were founded in this era, from the National Bureau of Standards, 1901, to the Forest Service, 1905, the Coast Guard, 1915, and the Bureau of Efficiency, 1916, the last designed to handle the problem of bigness by the twin arts of organization and acceleration, a bureau of bureaus. Mass came to mean anything that involved a giant and possibly terrifying quantity on a scale so great that it overwhelmed existing arrangements, including democracy. Mass production was coined in the 1890s when factories got bigger and faster, when the number of people who worked in them skyrocketed, and when the men who owned them got staggeringly rich. Mass migration dates to 1901, when nearly a million immigrants were entering the United States every year. Mass consumption to 1905, mass consciousness to 1912, mass hysteria had been defined by 1925, and mass communication by 1927, when the New York Times described the radio as a system of mass communication with a mass audience. And the masses themselves, they formed a mass audience for mass communication and had a tendency, psychologists believed, to mass hysteria, the political stampede, posing a problem unanticipated by James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the size of the continent and the growth of its population would make the republic stronger and its citizens more virtuous. They could not have imagined the vast economic inequality of the Gilded Age, its scale, its extravagance, and its agonies, and the challenge posed to the political order by millions of desperately poor men, women, and children, their opinions easily molded by the tools of mass persuasion. To meet that challenge in what came to be called the progressive era, activists, intellectuals, and politicians campaigned for and secured far-reaching reforms that included municipal, state, and federal legislation. Their most powerful weapon was the journalistic exposé. Their biggest obstacle was the courts, which they attempted to hurdle by way of constitutional amendments. Out of these campaigns came the federal income tax, the Federal Reserve Bank, the direct election of U.S. senators, presidential primaries, minimum wage and maximum hour laws, women's suffrage, and prohibition. Nearly all of these reforms had long been advocated for, and in many cases first by William Jennings Bryan. Progressives' biggest failure was also Bryan's, their unwillingness to address or even discuss Jim Crow. Instead, they propped it up. In all of what progressives accomplished in the management of mass democracy was vulnerable to the force that so worried the unrelenting Walter Lippmann, the malleability of public opinion into mass delusion. 1. Progressivism had roots in late 19th century populism. Progressivism was the middle-class version, indoors, quiet, passionless. Populists raise hell, progressives read pamphlets. Populists had argued that the federal government's complicity in the consolidation of power in the hands of big banks, big railroads, and big businesses had betrayed both the nation's founding principles and the will of the people, and that the government itself was riddled with corruption. The People's Party is the protest of the plundered against the plunderers, of the victim against the robbers, said one organizer at the founding of the People's Party in 1892. A vast conspiracy against mankind has been organized on the two continents and is rapidly taking possession of the world, said another. Progressives championed the same causes as populists and took their side in railing against big business. But while populists generally wanted less government, progressives wanted more, seeking solutions in reform legislation and in the establishment of bureaucracies, especially government agencies. Populists believed that the system was broken. Progressives believed that the governments could fix it. Conservatives, who happened to dominate the Supreme Court, didn't believe that there was anything to fix, but believed that if there was, the market would fix it. Notwithstanding conservatives' influence in the judiciary, progressivism spanned both parties. After 1896, when the Democratic Party convinced Bryan to run as a Democrat instead of as a populist, Democrats boasted that they had successfully folded populists into their party. In 1905, Governor Jeff Davis of Arkansas said, "In 1896, when we nominated the grandest and truest man the world ever knew, William Jennings Bryan, for president, we stole all the populist hate. We stole their platform. We stole their candidate. We stole them out lock, stock, and barrel." But Republicans were progressives, too. The citizens of the United States must effectively control the mighty commercial forces which they have themselves called into being, Theodore Roosevelt said. And as Woodrow Wilson himself admitted, when I sit down and compare my views with those of a progressive Republican, I can't see what the difference is. Much that was vital in progressivism grew out of Protestantism, and especially out of a movement known as the Social Gospel, adopted by almost all theological liberals and by a large number of theological conservatives, too. The name dates to 1886, when a Congregationalist minister took to calling Henry George's Progress and Poverty a social gospel. George had written much of the book with evangelical zeal, arguing that only a remedy for economic inequality could bring about the culmination of Christianity, the city of God on earth, with its walls of jasper and its gates of pearl. More skeptical and less religious liberals had long since lost faith with George's utopianism, Clarence Darrow shrewdly remarking, "The error I found in the philosophy of Henry George was its cocksureness, its simplicity, and the small value that it placed upon the selfish motives of men." The social gospel movement was led by seminary professors, academic theologians who accepted the theory of evolution, seeing it as entirely consistent with the Bible and evidence of a divinely directed, purposeful universe. At the same time, they fiercely rejected the social Darwinism of writers like Herbert Spencer, the English natural scientist who coined the phrase, the survival of the fittest, and used the theory of evolution to defend all manner of force, violence, and oppression. After witnessing a coal miner strike in Ohio in 1882, the Congregationalist Washington Gladden, a man never seen without his knee-length, double-breasted Prince Albert frock coat, argued that fighting inequality produced by industrialism was an obligation of Christians. "We must make men believe that Christianity has a right to rule this kingdom of industry, as well as all the other kingdoms of the world." Social gospelers brought the zeal of abolitionism to the problem of industrialism. In 1895, Oberlin College held a conference called The Causes and Proposed Remedies of Poverty. In 1897, Topeka minister Charles Sheldon, who got to know his parish by living among his poorest parishioners, spending 3 weeks in a black ghetto, sowed millions of copies of a novel, In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do?, about a minister in his congregation who wondered how Christ would address industrialism. Their answer? With progressive reform. In 1908, Methodists wrote a social creed and pledged to fight to end child labor and to promote a living wage. It was soon adopted by the 33-member Federal Council of Churches, which proceeded to investigate a steelworker strike in Bethlehem, ultimately taking the side of the strikers. William Jennings Bryan, hero of the plains, was a social gospeler in everything but name. After losing the election in 1896, though, he threw off his cross of gold and dedicated himself to a new cause, the protest of American imperialism. Bryan saw imperialism as inconsistent with both Christianity and American democratic traditions. Other progressives disagreed, Protestant missionaries in particular, seeing both Cuba and the Philippines as opportunities to gain new converts. The Spanish-American War, what boosters called a splendid little war, began in 1898. Cubans had been attempting to throw off Spanish rule since 1868, and Filipinos had been doing the same since 1896. Newspaper barons William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer came to side with the Cuban rebels, and eyeing a rich opportunity to boost their newspaper circulation, they sent reporters and photographers not only to chronicle the conflict, but, in Hearst's case, to stir it up. Newspaper lore has it that when one of Hearst's photographers cabled from Havana that war seemed unlikely, Hearst cabled back, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war." President McKinley sent a warship to Cuba as a precaution, but in February 1898, that ship, the USS Maine, blew up in Havana, killing 250 U.S. sailors. The cause of the explosion was unknown, and it would later be revealed to have been an accident, but both Hearst and Pulitzer published a cable from the captain of the battleship to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt, informing him that the disaster was no accident. The cable was later revealed to be a fake. Newspaper circulation soared, readers clamored for war. When Congress obliged by declaring war on Spain, Hearst fired rockets from the roof of the New York Journal's building. Pulitzer came to regret his part in the rush to war, but not Hearst. On his lead newspaper's front page, Hearst ran the headline, "How do you like the Journal's war?" 39-year-old Theodore Roosevelt, determined to see combat, resigned his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, formed the 1st U.S. Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, charged up San Juan Hill, and came back a hero. Even Bryan, 38, enlisted. He formed a volunteer regiment from Nebraska and went to Florida to prepare to fight, but was never sent into combat, McKinley having apparently made sure that Bryan, his presidential rival, had no chance for glory. Under the terms of the peace, Cuba became independent, but Spain ceded Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines to the United States in exchange for $20 million. A U.S. occupation and American colonial rule were not what the people of the Philippines had in mind when they threw off Spanish rule. The Philippines declared its independence, and Filipino leader Emilio Aguinaldo formed a provisional constitutional government. McKinley refused to recognize it, and by 1899, U.S. troops had fired on Filipino nationalists. "I know that war has always produced great losses," Aguinaldo said in an address to the Philippine people. "But I also know by experience how bitter is slavery." Bryan resigned his commission to protest the annexation, joining a quickly formed and badly organized anti-imperialist league whose supporters included Jane Addams, Andrew Carnegie, William James, and Mark Twain. Bryan, their best speaker, argued that the annexation of the Philippines betrayed the will of both the Filipino people and the American people. "The people have not voted for imperialism," he said. "No national convention has declared for it. No Congress has passed upon it." From its start in 1899, the Philippine-American War was an unusually brutal war, with atrocities on both sides, including the slaughter of Filipino civilians. U.S. forces deployed on Filipinos a method of torture known as the water cure, forcing a prisoner to drink a vast quantity of water. Most of the victims died. Meanwhile, in Washington, in the debate over the annexation of the Philippines, Americans revisited unsettled questions about expansion that had rent the nation apart during the War of Mexico, and unsettled questions about citizenship that remained the unfinished business of Reconstruction. The debate also marked the limits of the progressive vision. Both sides of this debate availed themselves at one time or another of the rhetoric of white supremacy. 8 million people of color in the Pacific and the Caribbean, from the Philippines to Puerto Rico, were now part of the United States, a nation that already, in practice, denied the right to vote to millions of its own people because of the color of their skin. On the floor of the Senate, those who favored imperial rule over the Pacific Island argued that the Filipinos were, by dint of race, unable to govern themselves. "How could they be?" asked Indiana Republican Albert J. Beveridge. "They're not of a self-governing race. They're Orientals." But senators who argued against annexation pointed out that when the Confederacy had made this argument about blacks, the Union had fought a war and staged an occupation over its disagreement with that claim. "You are undertaking to annex and make a component part of this government, islands inhabited by 10 million of the colored race, one half or more of whom are barbarians of the lowest type," said Ben Tillman, a one-eyed South Carolina Democrat who boasted of having killed black men and expressed his support for lynch mobs. "It is to the injection into that body politic of the United States of that vitiated blood, that debased and ignorant people, that we object." Tillman reminded Republicans that they had not so long ago freed slaves and then forced on the white men of the South at the point of the bayonet the rule and domination of those ex-slaves. "Why the difference? Why the change? Do you acknowledge that you were wrong in 1868? The relationship between Jim Crow and the war in the Philippines was not lost on black soldiers who served in the Pacific. An infantryman from Wisconsin reported that the war could have been avoided had white American soldiers not applied to the Filipinos' home treatment for colored peoples and cursed them as damned niggers. Rienzi B. Lemus of the 25th Infantry reported on the contrast between what he read in American newspapers and what he saw in the Philippines. "Every time we get a paper from there," he wrote home to Richmond, Virginia, "we read where some poor Negro is lynched for supposed rape." While in the Philippines, only when there was no Negro in the vicinity to charge for the crime were two white soldiers sentenced to be shot for raping a Filipino woman. The war that began in Cuba in 1898 and was declared over in the Philippines in 1902 dramatically worsened conditions for people of color in the United States, who faced at home a campaign of terrorism. Pro-war rhetoric, filled with racist venom, only further incited American racial hatreds. "If it is necessary, every Negro in the state will be lynched," the governor of Mississippi pledged in 1903. Mark Twain called lynching an epidemic of bloody insanities. By one estimate, someone in the South was hanged or burned alive every 4 days. The court's decision in Plessy v. Ferguson meant that there was no legal recourse to fight segregation, which grew more brutal with each passing year. Nor was discrimination confined to the South. Cities and counties in the North and West passed racial zoning laws banning blacks from middle-class communities. In 1890, in Montana, blacks lived in all 56 counties in the state. By 1930, they'd been confined to just 11. In Baltimore, blacks couldn't buy houses on blocks where whites were a majority. In 1917, in Buchanan versus Worley, the Supreme Court availed itself of the 14th Amendment not to guarantee equal protection for blacks, but to guarantee what the court had come to understand as the liberty of contract, the liberty of businesses to discriminate. In the spring of 1899, while teaching at Atlanta University, W.E.B. Du Bois was walking from his rooms on campus to deliver to the offices of a city newspaper a restrained essay about the lynching of Sam Hose, a black farmer, when he saw, displayed in a store window, Hose's knuckles. Hose had been dismembered and barbecued, his body parts sold as souvenirs. Du Bois, who had earned a Ph.D. in history at Harvard in 1895 before studying in Europe, had pioneered a new method of social science research that had become a hallmark of progressive-era reform, the social survey. In 1896, he'd gone door-to-door in Philadelphia's 7th Ward and personally interviewed more than 5,000 people in order to prepare his study, The Philadelphia Negro. In 1898, he'd delivered a meticulously argued academic lecture on the study of the Negro problems, which, while brilliant, was cluttered with blather like, the phenomena of society are worth the most careful and systematic study. But on that spring day in 1899, when he saw what had once been Hose's hands, he turned around and walked back to his rooms, threw away his essay, and decided that one could not be a calm, cool, and detached scientist while Negroes were being lynched, murdered, and starved. A lot of other people decided that they, too, couldn't keep calm, and like Du Bois, that they could no longer live in places like Georgia. "We are outnumbered and without arms," Ida B. Wells wrote. Instead, they packed up and left in what came to be called the Great Migration, the movement of millions of blacks from the South to the North and the West. Before the Great Migration began, 90% of all blacks in the United States lived in the South. Between 1915 and 1918, 500,000 African Americans left for cities like Milwaukee and Cleveland, Chicago and Los Angeles, Philadelphia and Detroit. Another 1.3 million left the South between 1920 and 1930. By the beginning of the Second World War, 47% of all blacks in the United States lived outside the South. In cities, they built new communities and new community organizations. In 1909 in New York, Du Bois helped found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the next year began editing its monthly magazine, The Crisis, explaining that its title came from the conviction that this is a critical time in the history of the advancement of man, a crisis for humanity. White progressives, who borrowed from the social science methods pioneered by Du Bois, turned a blind eye to Jim Crow. Like populists before them, when progressives talked about inequality, they meant the condition of white farmers and white wage workers relative to business owners. Yet progressives were undeniably influenced by the struggle for racial justice, not least by the investigative journalism methods pioneered by Wells with her expose of lynching. The expose became progressives' sharpest tool. After Theodore Roosevelt, alluding to Pilgrim's Progress, damned the man with the muckrake, who consistently refuses to see aught that is lofty and fixes his eyes with solemn intentness only on that which is vile and debasing, investigative journalism came to be called muckraking. It first became a national phenomenon at McClure's, a monthly magazine, when in 1902 its publisher, an Irish immigrant named Sam Sidney McClure, gave an investigative assignment designed to expose corruption and lawlessness to each of his three best writers, charging Ray Stannard Baker with writing about unions, Ida Tarbell about Standard Oil, and Lincoln Steffens about big city politics. Steffens later hired as his assistant a very young Walter Lippmann. None of these people like being described as a writer who sees only filth. Tarbell, who'd earlier written biographies of Napoleon and Lincoln, considered herself not a muckraker but a historian. And as Baker later insisted, we muckraked not because we hated our world, but because we loved it. Tarbell's indictment of Standard Oil, a catalog of collusion and corruption, harassment, intimidation, and outright thuggery, first appeared as a 19-part series in McClure's. Standard Oil, Tarbell wrote, was the first of the trusts, the model for all that followed, and the most perfectly developed trust in existence. Tarbell, who'd grown up next to an oil field, great oil pits sunken into the earth, had watched Standard Oil crush its competition, Often investigated by state and local governments, the company had left behind a paper trail, which Tarbell had followed doggedly in the archives. But it was her writing that brought her argument home. "There's nothing too good for them, nothing they did not hope and dare," she wrote of a group of young men starting out on their own in the industry, unaware of Standard Oil's methods. "At the very heyday of this confidence, a big hand reached out from nobody knew where to steal their conquest and throttle their future." In the wake of Tarbell's indictment, Rockefeller, who'd founded Standard Oil in 1870, became one of the most despised men in America, a symbol of everything that had gone wrong with industrialism. That Rockefeller was a Baptist and a philanthropist did not stop William Jennings Bryan from arguing that no institution should accept a penny from him. Bryan refused to serve on the board of his alma mater, Illinois College, until it broke ties with Rockefeller. "It is not necessary," Bryan said, "that all Christian people shall sanction the Rockefeller method of making money merely because Rockefeller prays." Muckraking fueled the engine of progressivism, but the car was driven by two American presidents, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, men who could hardly have been more different, but who, between them, vastly extended the powers of their presidency while battling against combinations of capital that had made corporations into monopolies. When Woodrow Wilson was a boy, reading Sir Walter Scott, he made a paper navy, appointed himself its admiral, and wrote his fleet a constitution. His graduating class at Princeton named him the class's model statesman. At the University of Virginia, he studied law, and he joined the debating society. A generation earlier, he'd have become a preacher like his father, but instead, he became a professor of political science. In the academy, and later in the White House, he dedicated himself to the problem of adapting a constitution written in the age of the cotton gin to the age of the automobile. A modernist impatient with his ancestors, Wilson believed that the separation of powers had gotten thrown out of whack. In Congressional Government, he argued that Congress had too much power and used it unwisely, passing laws pell-mell and hardly ever repealing any. He applied the theory of evolution to the Constitution, which he said is not a machine, but a living thing, and falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. He came to believe that the presidency had been evolving, too. "We have grown more and more inclined from generation to generation to look to the president as the unifying force in our complex system, the leader both of his party and of the nation. To do so is not inconsistent with the actual provisions of the Constitution. It is only inconsistent with a very mechanical theory of its meaning and intention." A president's power, Wilson concluded, is virtually limitless. His office is anything he has the sagacity and force to make it. People with a writerly bent who are interested in understanding American democracy tended to produce in those days sweeping accounts of the nation's origins and rise. During the years when Frederick Douglass and Frederick Jackson Turner were wrestling with the story of America, Wilson wrote a 5-volume History of the American People, and a young Theodore Roosevelt churned out a 4-volume series called The Winning of the West. Wilson was more interested in ideas, Roosevelt in battles. Roosevelt, who looked like a bear and roared like a lion, had finished a law degree at Columbia while serving in the New York State Assembly and spending a great deal of time at his ranch in western Dakota. But it was Roosevelt's fighting in the Spanish-American War that catapulted him to national fame. On his return from Cuba, he was elected the Republican governor of New York. 2 years later, when McKinley faced the Democratic nominee, William Jennings Bryan, he named Roosevelt as his running mate. "It was a mistake to nominate that wild man," McKinley's advisor Mark Hanna always said. But that wild man proved a tireless campaigner. "He ain't running, he's galloping," people said. In Roosevelt, Bryan met his match. Bryan traveled 16,000 miles on the campaign trail, so Roosevelt traveled 21,000. Bryan made 600 speeches, so Roosevelt made 673. Publicly, Roosevelt painted Bryan as a crackpot, with communistic and socialistic doctrines. Privately, he remarked that Bryan was supported by all the lunatics, all the idiots, all the knaves, all the cowards, and all the honest people who are slow-witted. Bryan to Roosevelt was the candidate of the lame-brained. When McKinley won, Democrats blamed Bryan, who, while he cornered the rural vote, had won not a single city except silver mining Denver. Democracy appeared to be dooming the Democratic Party. In 1880, one half the American workforce worked on farms. By 1920, only one quarter did. A great many people worked in factories, and a rising number of them, especially women, worked in offices. In 1880, clerks made up less than 5% of the nation's workforce, nearly all of them men. By 1910, more than 4 million Americans worked in offices, and half were women. By 1920, most Americans lived and worked in cities. Bryan's followers were farmers, and so long as he led the party, it was hard to see how Democrats could win the White House. Said one character in a humor column, "I wonder if us Democrats will ever lick the prison in again." In 1901, when McKinley was shot by an anarchist in Buffalo, Roosevelt, only 42, became the nation's youngest president. A great admirer of Lincoln, he wore on his hand a ring that contained a wisp of hair cut from the dead president's head. He bounded in and out of rooms and slapped senators on the back. But he read widely and deeply, and even though Pulitzer's World called him the strangest creature the White House ever held, he knew how to work the press. He gave reporters a permanent room in the White House and figured out that the best day to feed them stories was Sunday, so that their pieces would run at the beginning of the week. Roosevelt liked to say that he discovered Monday. His lasting legacy was the regulatory state, the establishment of professional federal government and scientific agencies like the Forest and Reclamation Services. Not far behind was the series of wildlife refuges and national parks he created. Much of the rest was bluster. "I'm not advocating anything revolutionary," Roosevelt himself said. "I am advocating action to prevent anything revolutionary." In the White House, Roosevelt pursued reforms long advocated by populists. Announcing that trusts are the creatures of the state, he set about using antitrust fervor to enact regulatory measures, principally through the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. Re-elected in 1904, when he easily defeated Alton B. Parker, a conservative whom Democrats had nominated out of their vexation with Bryan, Roosevelt continued to move to the left, pursuing an agenda, not always successfully, of regulating the railroads, passing pure food and drug laws, and ending child labor. Roosevelt also endorsed the income tax, a measure by now nearly universal in Europe. Between 1897 and 1906, supporters of the tax had introduced into Congress 27 bills proposing to defeat, with a constitutional amendment, the Supreme Court's decision in Pollock, overturning the 1894 federal income tax. "I feel sure that the people will sooner or later demand an amendment to the Constitution which will specially authorize an income tax," Bryan said at a rally in Madison Square Garden before an adoring crowd of 10,000 on his return from a year-long trip around the world. The momentum for change came in the form of an earthquake that hit San Francisco in 1906, spreading fires across the city and triggered by the collapse of insurance companies that were unable to cover hundreds of millions of dollars in earthquake damage claims, a financial panic across the country. In the election of 1908, after Roosevelt pledged that he would not run for a third term, a pledge he much regretted, the Republicans nominated William Howard Taft, Roosevelt's Secretary of War. The Democrats turned, once again, to Bryan, who demonstrated for the third and final time that while he could raise a crowd to its feet and leave them weeping, he could not deliver the White House to his party. President Taft, who had been a federal judge and who would go on to serve as Chief Justice of the United States, was perfectly willing to support a federal income tax, but he wanted to avoid signing a law that would end up going back to the Supreme Court. "Nothing has ever injured the presidency of the Supreme Court more than that last decision," he said about the court's decision in Pollock. Taft decided to support a constitutional amendment, which went to the states for ratification in 1909. Constitutional amendments are notoriously difficult to pass. The 16th Amendment was not, and its success is a measure of the reach and intensity of the progressive movement. It was ratified handily and swiftly in 42 of 48 states, six more than required, winning passage in state senates with an average support of 89% and in state houses, 95%. In 19 lower legislatures, the vote in favor was unanimous. The 16th Amendment became law in February 1913. The House voted on an income tax bill in May. When the Bureau of Internal Revenue printed its first 1040, the form was 3 pages, the instructions only 1. Americans later came to argue about the income tax more fiercely than almost anything they'd argued about before. But when it started, they wanted it, desperately and urgently. Industrialism had built towers tipped to the sky and had cluttered store shelves with trinkets, but it left workers with very little economic security. Beginning in the 1880s, industrializing nations had begun addressing this problem by providing working men's insurance, health insurance, industrial accident compensation, and old age pensions for wage workers, along with various forms of family assistance, chiefly to poor mothers or widows with dependent children. These programs created what came to be known as the modern welfare state. In the United States, the earliest of these forms of assistance were tied to military service. Between 1880 and 1910, under the terms of benefits paid to Civil War veterans and their widows and dependents, more than a quarter of the federal budget went to welfare payments. When Pennsylvania Congressman William B. Wilson introduced a pension plan for all